You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of the cover story, Going Solo, by Joanna Robinson. When Kit Harington trimmed his famous curls in 2015, fans were led to believe his character, presumed dead, wouldn't be returning to the show the following season. He did. But Clark swears her decision to go blonde has nothing at all to do with Danner's fate. I got to a point where I said I just want to look in the mirror and see something different. So I was just like, F it, it's the last season. I'm going to dye my hair blonde. Clark jokes that she immediately felt remorse and bought 9 baseball caps online, but they don't go with your outfit, so I don't wear them. Clark's brown hair had always been her shield. The blonde hair makes it harder to slip back into her pre-fame life. Partying with her old friends is tricky because their friends get weird about it, and she misses the mundane pleasures of, say, running errands with her mother. What I get most heartbroken about is that those opportunities are almost completely gone. Then she catches herself and apologizes for moaning about the champagne problems of fame. If I were reading this, I'd be like, cheer the F up, love. Back underneath that statue at the Met, Amelia Clark cranes her neck up to get a closer look at the ancient pharaoh's smooth granite face. Hatshepsut wears a false beard that allowed her to pass more easily through the male-dominated world. Our guide points out a faint piece of carved string running up the pharaoh's jawline, holding the disguise in place. Thinking about it later, Clark, who knows a thing or two about disguises, passing, alter egos, and powerful women, shakes her head in astonishment. That is some fascinating shit right there. A towering granite Daenerys statue may never find its way into the hallowed halls of the Met, but it's not clear Amelia Clark wants that anyway. As we duck out of the Met a bit behind schedule, only to find that it's raining and our sleek hired car is nowhere in sight, Clark gamely suggests we rush out into the downpour and dive into the back of a yellow cab. Our driver doesn't recognize Clark either, which puts her at ease. Unsure how to get to where we're going, he passes his smartphone to her so she can type the hotel's address into his GPS. "Don't worry, mate," she announces. "Your little app will get us there." A satisfied smile plays on her face as the taxi twists, turns, and bumps along. She looks happier than she ever has riding a dragon. Thank you. Now, a Vanity Fair spotlight by Rebecca Keegan. All the Right Moves, with photograph by Lauren Dukoff. Tracy Ellis Ross photographed in Los Angeles. One February morning on the Disney lot in Burbank, Tracy Ellis Ross was directing a pivotal episode of Black-ish, the ABC sitcom she has starred in as matriarch Rainbow Johnson for nearly 4 years. A location got changed, extras were involved, decisions had to be made, and the cast and crew, who had always been her peers, were looking to Ross for answers. After calling cut on the first scene, Ross ducked into her trailer and started texting her girlfriends. "I was like, okay, I'm effing terrified," Ross says, "like that shit was hard." Ross's group chat included Kerry Washington, Ava Longoria, America Ferrera, and Rashida Jones. She quickly received some high-powered affirmation. Ross marshaled two of her greatest resources, her tribe of friends, and her ability to push through fear, and stepped back on set. When the episode aired in April, it marked a new moment in her constant self-reinvention. The past year has been full of such moments for Ross, who recently delivered a TED Talk on female fury, appeared as a guest host on Jimmy Kimmel Live, and popped up in Drake's Nice For What video, shimmying in the desert in a silver sequined jumpsuit. It has also been a year of taking risk and of asking for more, including in a Black-ish salary renegotiation that was made public amid the industry-wide equality conversation sparked by Time's Up. "I don't know how that information got out," Ross says, "but I understand the interest because there is a larger, deeper, more important conversation going on that is not about me, but is about people being paid appropriately for their contribution and the work that they do, not because of their gender, race, or anything." Ross has spent a career dreaming bigger, Washington says, and if it seems she's having a career moment now, that's only because more people are paying attention. Tracy takes on new roles, new tasks, new responsibilities, new demands, Washington says. "She's always been that way. I couldn't be happier for the rest of the world that they've caught up with her. The business is finally catching up to the genius that is Tracy." one will be guaranteed to turn out like me. The Trump kids are bound by competition, old wounds, and their desire to cash in. Emily Jane Fox goes deep on the family dynamic, also known as Trump's most complex deal. This article is adapted from Born Trump, Inside America's First Family by Emily Jane Fox. Copyright 2018 by Emily Jane Fox. Reprinted with permission of Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Opening photo, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, and Eric Trump at their father's 50th birthday party, Trump Tower, 1996. 1. Americans wanted a royal family. On the morning of January 20, 2017, Donald Trump's five children formed a veritable wall around their father as he stood in the gallery on the west front of the Capitol building and placed his left hand atop two Bibles, one used by Abraham Lincoln at his inauguration in 1861, the other a gift from Trump's mother just before his 9th birthday to recite the presidential oath of office. It was an unprecedented political moment for America, but the scene also represented something of a domestic triumph. Trump, who had five children with three women over the course of four decades, had never quite been the platonic ideal of a paterfamilias. As the years passed, Trump and his kids underwent various stages of entrenchment and estrangement as his empire and personal life oscillated between booms and bust. The divorces, the Plaza acquisition and refinancing, the Atlantic City bankruptcies, the apprentice, the birther nonsense, 2016. He did not know, as his ex-wife Ivana Trump once put it, how to speak the children's language. Trump had even insinuated the limits of his own capacity as a nurturer. "I want five children, like in my own family," he once told a friend, according to a September 1990 article in this magazine. "Because with five, then I will know that one will be guaranteed to turn out like me." The Trumps have somewhat fancied themselves as a modern version of the Kennedys, but the inauguration brought to mind the dynamic of another sort of American first family, the Kardashians. The Trump kids had become famous in some ways simply for being famous, a preternatural and occasionally nauseating talent that they learned from their father. As Trump took the oath of office, Barron Trump, the president's middle school-aged son with Melania Trump, as well as Tiffany, his young adult daughter with Marla Maples, fixed their eyes on Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, who administered it. Meanwhile, Trump's eldest three children, Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric, stood like a phalanx, their eyes fixed on their father. Their ascent was something to behold in its own right. When Trump decided to run for president, as multiple people close to the family have reiterated to me, his eldest kids assumed that he would eventually succumb in the primaries, or to Hillary Clinton in the general election, and that they would return to their normal lives, to their various nuclear families and their jobs as executives of the family business, the Trump Organization. By Election Day, a concession speech had been drafted by a campaign official. Eric and Don Jr. had eyes toward the grand opening of the Trump International Hotel, Washington, D.C., and a forthcoming property in Vancouver. Ivanka Trump, according to a person familiar with her thinking, had a plan for breathing post-politics life back into her fashion line. The week before the election, she had submitted the manuscript for her book, Women Who Work, and anticipated the editing process. Executives at Portfolio, her publisher, felt that the manuscript was largely devoid of emotion. They solicited her to add personal, engaging details about her relationship with her parents, to make her seem like she had a pulse, one person involved with the book explained, like she was a human. But then came the dawn of their new reality, which had arisen with clarity on election night. They quickly seized on the opportunity. During the transition phase, Eric and Don Jr. continued to work through plans for a new chain of Trump hotels situated in heartland cities that, in part, might be able to monetize the fervent MAGA zeal. Ivanka worked with a lawyer to untangle some business interest and recruited her friend Dina Powell, a former George W. Bush aide and Goldman Sachs executive, to a nebulous advisory role that would presumably add to her own desired clout in Washington, where she planned to advocate for issues pertaining to working women. The family also started preparing for the inaugural celebration. Donald Trump had appointed Tom Barrack, a private equity billionaire who had negotiated the sale of the plaza to Trump in 1988, to run what the family hoped would be an outsize affair. Marquee performers, from Elton John to Kiss, distanced themselves as soon as their names were floated, and organizers ended up settling for the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and the Rockettes, minus some dancers in the troupe who refused to participate. Barrack spun the situation by noting that the inauguration already had its star power, the greatest celebrity in the world, as he put it, in the form of the incoming president. Ivanka Trump seemed particularly attuned to the stagecraft. When Melania Trump opened the White House residence to all of her husband's children for the weekend following the inauguration, the president's elder daughter put in a request to stay in the Lincoln bedroom. Permission granted. When Melania wavered over the idea of the customary parade down Pennsylvania Avenue after the swearing-in ceremony, citing security concerns, Ivanka dug in. "It's happening," she told an organizer. She worked with a stylist and told friends that she wanted a princess moment. "I told her it's an inauguration, not a coronation," one friend recalled. The sentiment was that Americans wanted a royal family. By the time the inauguration arrived, the family was done playing the very specific roles they had each carved out during the campaign. Don Jr., as the Second Amendment-abiding red stater, Ivanka as the palatable bridge to female voters, and Eric as the punctilious manager, the one working behind the scenes to make sure his father had the correct short list of candidates and advisors to select from. Long forgotten was Don Jr.'s offensive tweet comparing Syrian refugees to Skittles. The president-elect's remarks degrading women and Gold Star families, along with his locker room talk, which Ivanka had found objectionable, no longer stung as much. Other frustrations now seemed a lifetime ago. During the campaign, Ivanka privately took issue with the media for amplifying her father's infamous portrayal of a disabled New York Times reporter, insisting that he wasn't physically mimicking a handicapped person, but rather flagellating as he customarily did when imitating someone on a rant. She was also incensed that reporters construed Trump's comment that Megyn Kelly had blood coming out of her wherever during the first GOP primary debate as a minstrel reference. She reasoned to friends that her dad was a renowned germaphobe. Trump would use the same defense after certain allegations within the unverified Steele dossier were published. Tensions between Ivanka's husband, Jared Kushner, and brothers had also surfaced during the campaign. Eric told others during the run-up to the election that he felt Kushner, for his own gain, had taken advantage of some of the candidate's weaknesses. Kushner's family, likewise, had taken issue with their son an observant Orthodox Jew, going to work on the Sabbath after the infamous Access Hollywood tape surfaced. According to a person close to the family, even that one seismic event seemed distant. Now the Trump kids were free to be the truest expressions of their creator's ego. In reality, after all, despite Donald Trump's purported wishes, none of his children had turned out to be a true clone of their father. Rather, they had grown up to become a series of partial avatars, each of whom represented an individual strain of his personality. Don Jr., according to a former classmate, came to be known as Diaper Don at the University of Pennsylvania for his propensity to wet his pants while intoxicated, was the pit bull. Ivanka, who at age 15 had her name trademarked by her mother, was the showman addicted to the media game. Eric, who was 8 when his parents divorced, would inherit his father's arcane lust for real estate marketing. Their complementary personalities made them effective collaborators in the family business and subservient to their father, the evident sum of their component parts. Michael Cohen, one of Trump's attorneys, who worked closely with the family for years before federal agents raided his Midtown office, home, and hotel room, put it to me succinctly, "They're like mini superbots, mini Voltrons," he said. "Collectively, they make the whole." Next photo, Donald Trump is sworn into office January 20th, 2017. 2. I felt sorry for the kids. The matrix of the Trump kids' relationships, in many ways, has represented their father's most complex deal. As Ivana Trump relates in her 2017 memoir, Raising Trump, Don Jr., 40, Ivanka, 36, and Eric, 34, spent their formative years in the care of other people. Ivana also writes that she conceived all three while using IUD birth control. To look after the infant Don Jr., Ivana Trump hired a disciplinarian Swiss nanny who was quickly jettisoned on account of her militant sleep training. A German nanny somehow lasted 5 years, despite once leaving Don Jr. alone in a hot bath while tending to the family dog. Finally, by the time the family moved into Trump Tower in 1984, Ivana hired 2 Irish nannies who would essentially raise her children until each was sent off to boarding school. The Trump kids were sequestered on their own floor of Trump Tower, the 68th, a vast expanse that included a kitchen, the nanny's room, and 2 guest suites, one for Ivana's parents, Dado and Bobby, who spent months each year tending to the kids. Each child, Ivana writes, had his or her own bedroom, with a shared playroom stocked with stacks of Legos and Lincoln Logs, toy trucks and cars, videotapes and a big screen TV, and a game system that enticed their Trump Tower neighbor Michael Jackson to regularly come over for visits. According to Raising Trump, the children were never left alone with Jackson. Despite the opulence, the nannies kept the children on a strict schedule, as Ivana describes, up at dawn for breakfast, then a quick visit to their dad's office, some 40 floors below, and then off to school. Come afternoon, the nannies would retrieve them, and most often deliver them to their extracurricular activities. Eric took drawing classes at the Museum of Modern Art. Don Jr. primarily stuck to sports and outdoor activities. Ivanka studied piano for a few years, and according to a 1992 article in the New York Times, even played at a party her mother threw for Kathy Keaton, whose then-husband Bob Guccione had founded Penthouse. She took up ballet, too, appearing in performances of The Nutcracker at Lincoln Center as a student at the School of American Ballet. Michael Jackson turned up one year to watch her from backstage. Afterward, the children would come home, possibly say a cursory hello to their father as he rolled calls, and then retreat upstairs for an early dinner prepared by the nannies. Their parents would get dressed for their nights out. With Ivanka occasionally helping her mother choose which cocktail dress to wear, or watching her apply her makeup at her vanity. And once the Trumps would head off, the children said their prayers and were tucked into bed. Ivana Trump, as she tells it, was a strict enforcer of these regimens, though she left much of the day-to-day operations to the help. "My mother was much stricter than my father when we were growing up," Ivanka Trump once noted in an interview with the Evening Standard. "She was the disciplinarian. She is European. You didn't mess with mother." She recounted that when she was truly disobedient, her mother would pull down her pants and spank her in front of Ivanka's friends. "People are shocked, but she didn't chase me around with a whip. She didn't hesitate to punish her children. Mom was not afraid to spank," Eric says in Raising Trump. "If one of us messed up, he or she was punished, so we learned to behave." Otherwise, though, it was a life of extraordinary privilege. Many of the children's winter weekends were spent shuttling back and forth between New York and Palm Beach, particularly after Trump purchased Mar-a-Lago, where they spent their spring breaks. During winter vacation, the family flew out to Aspen and took up three suites, one for Donald and Ivana, one for the children, and one for Ivana's parents and the nannies, in the Little Nell, an exclusive ski-in, ski-out hotel. During their year-end break in Aspen in 1989, as Ivana Trump has recalled, the family was eating lunch at Bonnie's, the popular resort town restaurant, when she was confronted by Marla Maples, her husband's then-girlfriend. Maples has claimed that Ivana confronted her. Those who witnessed the whole thing may not be sure who started the fracas, but they do remember the crescendo. There was so much yelling, punctuated by Maples declaring, "I'm Marla and I love your husband," that the restaurant's other patrons were mortified. "It was horrible," said one local Aspen woman in attendance. "I felt sorry for the kids, for the whole family, really." After Liz Smith reported the news of the couple's marital troubles in the New York Daily News, Donald Trump moved out of the triplex and to an apartment on a lower floor of Trump Tower, and Ivana sat her children down individually to break the news. Despite the tabloid furor, she was determined to ensure that the reckoning was not going to upset the rhythm of the children's lives. The emotional trauma, however, would haunt the kids for years. Don Jr. stopped talking to his father for a time. Ivanka was wounded. Meanwhile, according to her memoir, Ivana Trump moved the family down to Mar-a-Lago for 3 months to recuperate. Each day, the children would complete the homework assignments that their teachers dutifully sent every morning. They'd play tennis and go swimming and spend considerable time with Ivana's parents. The family spent part of the summer in Czechoslovakia and returned in time for Don Jr. to move to Pottstown, Pennsylvania, to start his first year of boarding school. 3. You should be mad at your family. The elder Trump children may embody their own narrow strains of their father's personality, but two traits are common among all three: a dogged work ethic coupled with an intrinsic desire to cash in on their dad's opportunities. Throughout their formative years, the Trump kids flirted with alternative career paths. Ivanka started modeling as a teenager. Then, after attending Georgetown and the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, her father's alma mater, she took a job working for a family friend's real estate firm before eventually wending her way to the Trump Organization. Don Jr., after graduating from Penn, enjoyed a rumspringa in Aspen, where he worked as a bartender, hunted, and generally enjoyed the life of an unencumbered outdoorsman. He had felt frosty toward his father after the divorce, but ultimately chose to occupy an office one floor below him. Eric Trump didn't even take a gap year after graduating from Georgetown, preferring instead to join the family company immediately. Eric's arrival at Trump Tower in 2006 marked the first time since Don Jr. had left her for boarding school nearly 15 years earlier that the siblings were all together for a prolonged period. And in many ways, it helped forge the closest connection that they had ever had with their dad. Sure, they would see him in his office before or after school. He would write them notes and call them when they were with their mother or on campus. As Ivana Trump said in an interview last year, when the kids were 21 years old, I called Donald and I said, "Here's the final product, and now it is your job to continue." Trump's 2016 run for the White House put the siblings in a pressurized environment akin to their childhood, one that, at various times, allied them with one another or put distance between them. It was an elaborate, albeit familiar, form of semi-choreographed ego stroking. Ivanka reveled in the opportunity to introduce her father's now famous descent down the Trump Tower escalator as he announced his bid for the Republican nomination. Awkwardly, she also stood there alone for nearly 2 full minutes as Rockin' in the Free World filled the vaulting lobby and her father waited for his self-appointed cue. After Trump's speech, opening with the lines, "Wow, whoa, that is some group of people, thousands," Don Jr. was fairly radiant. During the elevator ride back upstairs, his phone would not stop dinging. "My special forces friend just texted me," he said, according to a person close to the family. "He loved it." A handful of the people with whom he hunted big game sent him similar messages. "They effing loved it," he said. From there, Don Jr., perhaps the only real conservative in the family, was dispatched onto the trail. Ivanka often introduced her father at campaign events, providing a gauzy overview to his often rambling fulminations. Eric would regularly appear on Fox News, as would his wife Lara. The entire brood routinely sat in the family section at the debates, participated in town halls, and had dinners at diners in the frigid New Hampshire winter. According to a person familiar with the family's conversations, they had a sense of the fleeting and unique nature of the experience, and frequently invited childhood friends and close associates to come with them backstage at debates or other important rallies. On the night Trump clinched the Indiana primary, he reflected on the untraditional unity of his modern family. "It's a beautiful thing to watch, and it's a beautiful thing to behold, and we're going to make America great again." Trump also went on to single out his son-in-law, praising him for the work he had done to get him to that point. "Honestly, Jared is a very successful real estate person, but I actually think he likes politics more than he likes real estate," he told the audience, sending Ivanka into a laughing fit, "but he's very good at politics." Next photos, Ivana Trump and son Donald Jr., photographed by Harry Benson at Mar-a-Lago, 1992. Ivanka and her father at an event at the Plaza, 1991. Trump and Eric at the U.S. Open, 1991. Jared Kushner's rise to a senior position in the Trump campaign may have caused some friction with his brother-in-law Eric, but the most awkward family campaign dynamics of all had to do with the Kushner clan's own history. By the spring of 2016, Trump had settled on Chris Christie, then the governor of New Jersey, to run his transition team, and was even considering him as a potential running mate. The choice was awkward on many fronts. Not only had Christie been critical of Trump during the primaries, but in Christie's former career as a U.S. attorney, he had prosecuted Kushner's father. the imprisonment of Charles Kushner, who served 14 months in an Alabama federal prison, had a profound impact on his family. Years later, Jared Kushner still held a grudge against the governor, in part because the Kushner family believed that Christie, possibly out of spite, had balked at a decision that might have allowed Charlie Kushner the chance to depart prison a month early. The simmering tension was no secret. In early May, Trump invited the governor to his office on the 26th floor of Trump Tower for a small group meeting. Campaign manager Kari Lewandowski and Jared Kushner joined them, and they began to hammer out what points to make in the press release announcing Christie's appointment. Lewandowski tweaked the language in the document, Christie fiddled with it, and Trump eventually approved a draft. Kushner was more cautious. "Well, we don't have to rush this," he told them, according to someone familiar with the conversation. "Let's take our time with this." Lewandowski interrupted to say that, in fact, they did have to rush this. The Obama White House had already asked for the name of the transition team leader, and it was likely to come up in a matter of days when the two groups were due to sit down together. They needed to decide then and there, Lewandowski said. Trump agreed. Unlike Charlie Kushner, who is known to have a ferocious temper, Jared, according to a person close to the family, often fumed quietly. The angrier he grew, oftentimes, the quieter he became. So when he opened his mouth that day, he was at a little more than a whisper. It was rare for him to talk about his father's stint in prison, but Kushner delivered an impassioned soliloquy. "It's unfair," Jared said at one point, succinctly, according to someone with direct knowledge of the conversation. "Christie took advantage of my family members for his own ambition." Kushner declined to comment. As he sat there listening, Christie was incredulous, but Trump jumped to his defense. "The guy was just doing his job," Trump said, chastising his son-in-law, according to this person. "If you were there, you would have done the same thing. You really should be mad at your own family here. They are the ones who turned over all that information to Chris." According to this person, Trump went on to say that Kushner's real problem was that he hadn't known Trump at the time of his father's trial. If he had, things might have turned out differently, given the friendship between Trump and Christie. Christie interrupted, according to this person, suggesting that was not the case. Trump protested, suggesting that it would have been different. The White House declined to comment. Christie declined to comment. Trump then suggested that he, Christie, and Jared and Charlie Kushner go out to dinner together to clear the air. Jared replied that that might not be the best idea. At this point, Lewandowski looked aghast. Trump turned to Kushner and told him his final decision. He was picking Christie. Kushner subsequently left the room. Tensions lingered, of course. According to a person with knowledge of the situation, Trump and Kushner called Charlie Kushner to break the news, asking for his blessing and making sure that the Christie decision would not irreparably damage the in-laws' relationship. During the call, according to this person, Charlie Kushner listened patiently before explaining, "Listen, the most important thing is that you win." The elder Kushner seemed genuinely magnanimous. Privately, however, the father-son follow-up conversation was different in its tone. A person close to the family recalled that Charlie Kushner told his son that Christie would accept the post, but eventually it would work out. 6 months later, Christie was fired. A spokeswoman for Charlie Kushner did not respond to request for comment. A spokesman for Jared Kushner declined to comment. 4. Vank, this isn't the speech for that. In late 2015, the Secret Service began providing a detail for Donald Trump, codename Mogul, but it wasn't until the fall of 2016 that security was provided for Ivanka. Settling on nicknames is somewhat of a process, one that allows protectees an opportunity to exercise their own vanity. Since the call signs within a first family begin with the same first letter, the rest of the Trumps fell in line with M names. Melania landed on Muse. Ivanka went for Marvel. Eric, a spectacular shot, chose Marksman. Don Jr., for obvious reasons, picked Mountaineer. From the beginning, Ivanka and Jared were honest with their detail about the possibility that they would move to Washington after the election. Don Jr., Mountaineer, less comfortable with the idea of protection. For starters, he was generally more private than his sister. He went to his second home in the Catskills to fish and build bonfires and roam around on ATVs with his kids most weekends, and took off for days-long hunting trips in the most remote parts of the Canadian bush, looking for moose, and 10-day fishing trips in Alaska. He enjoyed the anonymity provided to him in this world, which was now ending. It didn't help, either, that he and his wife, Vanessa, had 5 kids living in New York City, which meant that she had to manage essentially 6 different details, one for her and her husband, and one for each of her children. Her phone frequently lit up with text and calls from agents, telling her one kid was a few minutes late to meet them on their designated street corner, asking if they would be on the north or south side of the street, or what time she planned to leave the house for their drive upstate for the weekend, or who was staying late at school that afternoon. It is literally overwhelming, a former Secret Service agent explained. Trying to manage all that with seasoned staff would be mind-numbing. To have someone who's never done it before try and juggle all of that, well, it would just be horrific. Vanessa filed for divorce in March. But by Election Day, it seemed to many on Team Trump that this sort of star treatment was coming to an end. By around 5 o'clock, when the first dismal round of returns started rolling in, the 3 eldest kids began calling in to local polling stations in some of the battleground states to make a last push. Jared phoned a few media friends. He asked one senior executive at a major news organization what he was hearing about exit polling in Florida, a must-win state, given Clinton's presumable firewall across Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. The executive told him it didn't look promising. Kushner subsequently called Matt Drudge, who, according to this same executive, told him there was reason for hope. The press, he believed, had been miscalculating Trump's prospects the whole time. By sundown, campaign officials packed the headquarters on the 5th floor of Trump Tower, and as the exit polls delivered the shocking results, Trump stood in the kitchen of his triplex and called down to see his acceptance speech. Policy aide Stephen Miller told those around him that he had an exquisitely drafted concession speech. The victory speech was just bullet points. So Miller, Mike Pence, Christie, and the elder Trump kids started composing one. Ivanka pointed out that it would be a great opportunity to reach out to women, who undoubtedly would appreciate reassurance after watching the first female presidential nominee lose in stunning fashion. "Ivanka," Jared interrupted, according to one person present, "this isn't the speech for that. We have plenty of time to get to that later." Once it became clear that the race was unmistakably going in Trump's direction, the mood in the triplex shifted to a mix of shock and outright giddiness. Jared threw his arm around Christie, saying, "We did this." 5. You do so at your own peril. At inaugural ball, the night before the president-elect's ascent, Donald and Melania danced awkwardly to a rendition of Frank Sinatra's My Way. About 3 minutes into the song, Mike and Karen Pence joined them. Then something unusual occurred. Ivanka and Jared appeared on stage, followed by Don Jr. and Eric, with their wives behind them, along with Tiffany and her then-boyfriend. Planners were caught by surprise. As far as organizers thought, the president and first lady were supposed to share their first dance alone on stage with the vice president and second lady. That was something the kids decided to do on their own, explained one person involved in the transition planning. It turns out, however, that it was their father's doing. Knowing what a bad dancer he is and how long the song would go on, he enlisted his kids to come out to take some pressure off. They came out even earlier in the song by the second inaugural ball, once they saw how awkward it was at the first. From there, the Trump kids turned Washington, D.C. into their own veritable 68th floor of Trump Tower. They spent the rest of the weekend in the residence or shuttling to more official events. On Saturday evening, Ivanka's then 3-year-old son, Joseph, slid toy cars down the aisle at the National Cathedral service. Don Jr. and his wife and kids went bowling in the White House basement. Ivanka's youngest, Theodore, crawled for the first time in the state dining room. Jared Kushner was sworn into his role as senior advisor to the president in a ceremony in the East Room, where his parents and brother sat alongside Ivanka and their children to take it all in. It was just like a family business, except, of course, that it isn't. Early on in the administration, Nordstrom dropped Ivanka's line, and coastal customers shied away from it in department and discount stores. Watchdog organizations have filed suits claiming that the Trump Hotel in Washington violates the emoluments clauses of the Constitution, and one such case seems to be gaining legal traction. Standing before Chief Justice Roberts on Inauguration Day, Trump's eldest kids could have never presaged what would fall them. Not merely the imbroglios surrounding crowd sizes, travel bans, and Charlottesville, but also the fiascos coalescing around Comey, Mueller, and Cohen. Jared Kushner was reportedly a target of influence operations by no fewer than four nations. By mid-April of this year, Cohen, who once told me he thought of the Trumps as family, found himself in unprecedented legal jeopardy. The Wall Street Journal reported that Trump insiders worried he might flip. Regardless of whether Cohen is indicted or whether the Trump name can still retain its marketing cachet in certain pockets of the country, the Trump Organization is now facing critical legal issues regarding its properties from the Republic of Georgia to Indonesia, Azerbaijan to Brazil. Don Jr. and Ivanka have been investigated for alleged financial crimes involving the Trump Soho in Manhattan, though that probe never got anywhere. Investigators are also reported to be looking into one of Ivanka's business deals related to the Trump Tower, the Trump Hotel, rather, in Vancouver. Part of the reason this chaotic collection of mini Voltrons worked in harmony was that Donald Trump was at the center of it all. So what happens when one day he isn't? Some people close to the family have presented an optimistic outlook. Eric, they say, knows how to operate golf properties. Don Jr. is a seasoned dealmaker. Ivanka is an expert marketer. Some, in fact, wonder if they need Dad at all to run his business. As I always say, if you underestimate Donald Trump, you do so at your own peril, Sam Nunberg, a former Trump associate, said. The same is true for the kids. Thank you. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.